Good day. Today is Thursday, 9th October 2025, and may I first, before I get into the substance of this video, remind you, if you've liked this video or you've liked some parts of this video which you've watched, to press the like button at the conclusion of doing so. Now, with that, let me move forward and discuss the topics that we're going to discuss today. And again, I am mainly going to discuss the situation in Ukraine, but I'm just going to say a few words about the agreement that's just been made between Israel, Egypt, the United States, and Hamas on a ceasefire in Gaza. And President Trump is saying that phase one of his 20-point plan, I've already explained that it is, in fact, a plan mostly worked out in the past by the Arab states, though there is no doubt that Donald Trump has made his own contributions. But anyway, the phase one of the plan has now been agreed. Hamas is releasing all of the Israeli hostages that are still under its control. The Israelis are also agreeing to release various prisoners that they hold, and that they're going to be pulling back from territory that they have recently occupied in Gaza, and that there is to be a ceasefire. The further negotiations will presumably address what I am sure are going to be the much more challenging and difficult issues: Hamas's disarmament. Unsurprisingly, Hamas has been strongly pushing back against that. Deployment of peacekeepers to Gaza, something which I am sure that the Israeli authorities will not be happy about, and other matters of that kind. It seems also that the ceasefire, which is supposed to be coming into effect, could be in effect by the time you're watching this program. Now, I have grave doubts, extreme skepticism, that this plan in its totality is going to work, and I've explained why. I don't think that the Israeli government, the Israeli authorities, are going to welcome a peacekeeping force in Gaza, especially one which will inevitably be drawn mostly from the Arab states and other Muslim states, with Indonesia perhaps making the biggest contribution. And Hamas obviously is going to resist any demands that it disarm. And even if it does agree to disarm, I expect that it will retain access to many of its weapons, and it won't hand over most of them. And it will continue to be probably the dominant political force in Gaza, because I cannot see how events can play out otherwise. So I am very, very sceptical about the prospects of this plan. I also have to say that part of me worries that the reason that the United States, and for the moment Prime Minister Netanyahu, are going forward with this plan is that they want to have a period at least of quiet in Gaza as they crank up for their forthcoming attack on Iran, which I expect is their higher priority. Just saying. But with all of that, it is nonetheless still a good thing that there is a ceasefire in Gaza, however temporary, that some Israeli troops are being pulled back, that hostages are being released, and that prisoners held by the Israelis are being released also. It is good for all of those people who are being released, and of course it is also good for their families. One can spend an enormous amount of time judging the geopolitical implications of these matters, as of course I do, but one should never lose sight of the human aspect. For the moment at least, people are being released. there is a ceasefire in Gaza. I'm not sure whether it is yet in effect, but I hope that it will be in effect within the next few hours. That will give people an opportunity to try at least to put their lives back together, and that those things altogether are good things. Now, I expect that we will be discussing these events in more detail in a dedicated program of the Duran, and besides, anyway, I'll be on standby to follow developments and to see whether this process continues and leads somewhere. Today, this is all I'm going to say about this news from Gaza that we have just had. Let us now return to the primary topic of these programs, which is the conflict in Ukraine. And I'm going to make a number of very general observations, which is that it looks to me increasingly as if peace talks about achieving peace have completely broken down. I don't see any sign of anything like this happening at all. I'm not sure that the President of the United States, who's been the main driver in trying to get peace talks going since his inauguration in January, has any further interest in the matter. So I see no sign of any movement towards peace whatsoever. But it is also absolutely clear to me that while the Russians on the battlefronts moving forward according to a clear operational plan and have objectives on the battlefronts which they are achieving, on the other side, there is really no plan to speak of at all. We have President Trump's comments made a few days ago about the fact that he sort of made a decision about supplying Tomahawks to Ukraine. He hasn't made a decision whether he will do it, but he sort of made a decision, whatever that means. He says that he still needs to know what the Ukrainians intend to do with those weapons. And I've said already that is a fatuous and absurd claim, since Zelensky has never made any secret of his plans to use Tomahawks to attack the Russian political leadership and the Russian energy system. We've had more comments from other Ukrainian officials about this. A member of the Ukrainian parliament had a discussion with the Daily Telegraph. And, well, from the comments this person made, one almost got the sense that these weapons, if they were ever supplied to Ukraine at all, would quite plausibly never be launched. And it was all made to look a little bit like a bluff, an attempt to scare the Russians in some way into, well, beginning negotiations, which is what the Ukrainians and their friends always say. But of course, they don't really mean meaningful negotiations. What they really mean is the Russians capitulating to Ukrainian and Western demands. So, principally, an attempt to scare the Russians. And Zelensky, in his most recent comments that he's just made, has essentially said the same. He said that he's discussed the question of Tomahawk missile deliveries with Trump. Trump has not excluded the idea, not rejected the idea that there are technical discussions about supplying the Tomahawks. Presumably, these are mostly taking place within the context of the US government. Issues like the launch system that is going to be used, for example. Zelensky made it perfectly clear that if he ever does get his hands on the Tomahawks, even though in reality it will be the Americans who will make all the guidance decisions, and who will launch the Tomahawks, the purpose of supplying Ukraine with the Tomahawks supposedly is to scare the Russians into negotiations. And that presumably is what he's telling Trump. Now, there is no possibility whatsoever that supplies of Tomahawk missiles are going to scare the Russians into negotiations. On the contrary, it is going to make the Russian position even harder than it already is, and it is hardening by the day. Zelensky, who presumably has had many dealings with the Russians, or at least indirectly with the Russians, over the last 4 years, and by the way, who once met with Putin shortly after he was elected president of Ukraine, probably himself doesn't really believe in this fiction that the Russians are going to be scared if the United States deploys Tomahawk missiles to Ukrainian territory, which is what essentially delivering Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine would really mean. But I can very well imagine that that is what he and others are telling Donald Trump. Give the Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, send them to Ukraine, threaten to use them, and if the Russians don't heed those threats, actually use them. And sooner or later, that's going to scare the Russians into some kind of major climb down. They will at that point negotiate, and they will agree to all of the things that we ask: a freeze of the conflict on the existing conflict lines, enabling Ukraine to build up its military forces, to join NATO and the EU, all preparatory for some major advance by Ukraine eastwards with the full backing of NATO to regain possession of its lost lands. I am sure that that is the message that Trump is receiving. And unfortunately, I have to say this, I think Donald Trump, who is constantly looking for leverage over the Russians, he believed that threats of sanctions and tariffs and attempts to interfere with the Russian oil trade might provide him with that leverage, but he's, over the last 10 months, discovered otherwise. Anyway, Trump, constantly looking for this leverage, trying to find means to scare the Russians or bluff the Russians into major concessions, I am very much afraid is going to fall for this. He is going to accept the claims, the words that have been passed to him from Kellogg and Mike Waltz and Zelensky himself and the various European advocates of this foolish, reckless proposal, and he's going to supply the Tomahawk missiles. And, well, just to say it again, if that is correct, if this is a correct reconstruction of his thinking, then he is profoundly and completely wrong. It is not going to increase his leverage over Russia at all. On the contrary, it's going to make the Russians take an even tougher line, as I've just said, than the one that they're currently taking. And this quest constantly for leverage over the Russians, sanctions on the Russians themselves, sanctions on Russian banks, seizing of ships on the high seas. And it's important to stress, oil tankers that deliver oil from Russia are mostly flying, sailing under different flags, flags of third countries. They're delivering cargo, oil, crude oil and refined oil to other countries whose citizens are, and companies are buying that oil. Anyway, all of these attempts, the threats to impose massive tariffs on China and India to restrict Indian and Chinese purchases of Russian oil, all of these attempts at leverage, which failed in the past, they're not going to be any more successful if the resort instead now is to trying to use missiles to strike at the Russian energy system. My own sense, actually, is that it is Trump himself who ultimately came up with this plan. There is this version of a conversation he had with Zelensky back, I think it was in July, in which he supposedly asked Zelensky, "Why are you not launching missiles on Moscow itself?" And Zelensky shot back, "Well, we will do that if you give us the missiles." And Zelensky and others have seized on this, and they've been telling Trump ever since, "Look, you want leverage over the Russians? We will give you leverage over the Russians. The tariffs on India and China, maybe they're not going to be successful after all. They can't work after all. So let's go for this. You brought up the idea of the missile strikes. Just give us the missiles, the Tomahawk missiles, and we will do it for you. And yes, that will bring the Russians to the negotiating table, and you will get your peace, your freeze of the conflict, and you'll be able to get your Nobel Peace Prize if that's what you want, and all of those things." So I suspect that this is what this has been all about and why things are being plugged and pushed in this way. Anyway, that, however, brings me back to the further point. The West has no leverage over the Russians. And the Danish Prime Minister, Mrs. Frederiksen, has just again said as much. They're running out of money to send to Ukraine. The German government, Friedrich Merz, is now moving forward with cuts to Germany's historically established by none other than Bismarck in the 19th century, and formerly very generous social security system. There is currently talk in Germany of eventually increasing the retirement age to 73. Germany is giving 9 billion euros a year to Ukraine, even as it demands these huge cuts in social spending that must be absorbed by German citizens. Even Merz probably realizes that there will come a point when this becomes impossible to sell to an already restive German electorate. The AfD has now become increasingly well established in German opinion polls as Germany's most popular party. So Germany will struggle to keep up further payments to Ukraine, the 9 billion euros that it is promising to Ukraine, 9 billion euros a year that it is promising to Ukraine. In the Czech Republic, Mr. Babiš has won the election in part on a promise that the Czech Republic will not be providing any further financial support for Ukraine. He has just reiterated this, by the way, as he works to form a coalition government. And by the way, the parties that are most likely to join his coalition agree with him on this. Some of them want to go further, and some of them actually talk about the Czech Republic actually quitting NATO and the EU, though Mr. Babish himself won't go that far. And, of course, in Britain and in France, well, the financial burden of supporting Ukraine is also getting heavier as Britain struggles with a huge budget deficit and a stagnating economy. And of course, the same is even more true in France, where, as I rather expected, President Macron is again trying to find himself another prime minister to cobble a budget together, rather than do what has to be done, which is to dissolve the parliament and call elections. And again, the reason, of course, is that, as everybody can see, the budget in France is out of control. So Ms. Fredrickson is absolutely right. The ability to continue to fund Ukraine in Europe is becoming exhausted. And of course, the cost of doing this is piling up, because the Americans say that they will send weapons to Ukraine, but the Europeans must pay for them. And of course, the Ukrainians themselves need huge amounts of funding to cover their costs. And the Ukrainians, by the way, are also saying that money that the Europeans are allocating or want to allocate from the 140 billion euro loan that Ursula and Merz are trying to cobble together, that money, which is supposed to be used for weapons purchases, the Ukrainians want at least part of it to be used to cover other holes in their budget. Their budget deficit, Ukraine's budget deficit, is growing all the time. So the Europeans funding Ukraine, supporting Ukraine, having to buy weapons from the United States for Ukraine, keeping Ukraine constantly on life support, are finding the cost of doing so increasingly unbearable. And it is likely to get even more difficult to continue to fund Ukraine, because of certain things that the Russians have been doing. So over the last week, the Russians, as I've discussed in several programs on this channel, have conducted strikes on Ukraine's energy system. And they have apparently completed the destruction of Ukraine's domestic oil industry. Ukraine no longer refines its own oil, so it imports all of its gasoline. Before 2022, much of Ukraine's gasoline was refined in a major refining plant in the city of Kremenchuk. The Russians first attacked that oil refinery in 2022, and they have continued to attack it at regular intervals since. And apparently that oil refinery is offline, as apparently are six others that Ukraine has or used to have. But even more critically, the Russians have recently taken to launching strikes against Ukraine's once very big and very important natural gas industry. The industry that managed the pipelines that brought gas from Russia to Europe, the pipelines crossed Ukraine, as we all know. The major underground reserves where Ukraine pumped its oil, its natural gas, which it drew upon for the winter. Anyway, the Russians have launched missile strikes against these big gas reserves. And according to Bloomberg, 60% of Ukraine's gas reserves have now been destroyed, leaving Ukraine critically short of gas reserves for the winter. And it is likely that the Russians are going to maintain the pace of their attacks. Indeed, over the last two nights, there have been more Russian drone and missile attacks on Ukraine, though on a smaller scale than on previous nights and days. But anyway, the Russian offensive in the sky continues unabated. So where does Ukraine get its gasoline and its diesel oil and its natural gas from now? It is getting it from Europe. The European Union has to export gas and oil and gasoline and diesel to Ukraine to keep what is left of Ukraine's economy going. And all of this, of course, comes at an enormous price. A price which Ukraine itself is obviously unable to pay. It runs a massive deficit, budget deficit. I read reports somewhere claiming that it was up to 50% of Ukraine's GDP. I might have got that wrong, by the way. That does seem much too high, but it is running a huge budget deficit. It's running a trade deficit also, I believe, because pretty much all finished goods now have to be imported to Ukraine. Ukraine's industries have basically been broken, and to the extent that they function at all, they are all committed to the war effort. And Ukraine still has an agricultural sector which still functions and still exports grain and food, but in all other essentials, its industrial economy is paralyzed, is broken. And sustaining it is a major burden on the European states, on the EU. So the European states have accumulating budget problems, which are getting worse. The cutoff of Russian natural gas has resulted in a huge spike in energy costs right across the European Union, and by the way, also in Britain. We see deindustrialization taking hold in Germany. There's been, by the way, a significant rise in unemployment in Germany as well. Bosch, the major engineering company, which is best known to many people from its extremely reliable and high quality range of household appliances, has just had to make 22,000 workers redundant. So Europe, faced by these enormous accumulating costs, is running out of funds, even borrowed funds, to pay for these costs, to pay the costs of sustaining the war. So what does it do? Well, Ms. Frederiksen gave the answer. It seizes the Russian assets. It floats this loan, 140 billion euro loan, and tries to secure them against these Russian assets, so that if Ukraine cannot repay this loan, and not a single person, I think, on planet Earth believes that Ukraine is ever going to repay this loan, well, then the assets themselves, the Russian assets, will kick in, and it will be through them that the loan is repaid. Now, that's what the theory is, but I'm going to express my own personal belief, given that nobody expects that Ukraine is ever going to repay this so-called loan. And given that the Russians are never going to agree that their assets be used in this way as reparations paid to Ukraine, which will instead be used to repay this loan, I think that what is really going to happen is that the capital is actually going to be taken out of Euroclear and simply handed over to Ukraine, and the loan, the 140 billion loan that we're hearing so much about, is going to simply be there on the books. Just to say, that's my own view. I am sure that Ursula and Mautz and people like that will furiously push back on this if it is ever put to them that way. They will say, of course, we are not touching the capital. But I can't myself see how this can happen, how this can be done without it happening. Anyway, whether I'm right or wrong about that, Fredriksen says that this is the only game in town. She has not heard of any other proposals to fund Ukraine than by doing this thing. And that brings us back to the realities of this game of poker that the Europeans and perhaps Donald Trump think they're playing with the Russians, with Vladimir Putin. Now, when Vladimir Zelensky came to Washington back in February, when he had his altercation with Trump and Vance in the Oval Office, Trump said to Zelensky, "You have no cards." The reality is that nor do the Europeans, nor ultimately in dealing with Putin, does Donald Trump himself. He may think that the Tomahawk missiles are a card, but the Russians don't play poker and they don't see it in that way. And as for continued European funding of Ukraine, well, the Europeans are running out of financial space. Now, to say this again, Ukraine's costs run into the hundreds of billions every year. If this war were to continue beyond next year, beyond 2026, well, the 140 billion euros that this loan is supposed to amount to, and I say loan in inverted commas, as I said, I think what we're really talking about is handing over all the finance, all the capital to Zelensky, the Russian capital to Zelensky. Well, all that does is buy at most an extra year, 2026 to be precise. Perhaps it won't even run for that long. Just saying. I cannot see how the numbers add up. I don't see how, by the way, the mathematics of the loan, as they are officially presented, add up either. In a recent program that we did on the Duran, Alex Christoforou said that the interest of the Russian assets is supposed to amount to $1.5 billion a year on a capital amount of about $300 billion. That seems to me about right. But the Western powers, the Europeans, have already floated all sorts of loans and devices for supporting Ukraine on the back of that interest, and I can't myself remotely see how that interest amount, $1.5 billion, can possibly cover the cost of the loans which have already been raised. As Alex Cristoforo pointed out, the amount of the capital that the Europeans are dealing with, the Russian capital that the Europeans are dealing with, seems to change continuously. Sometimes it's 270 billion euros in Euroclear. At other times it was 170 billion euros in Euroclear. Now we're being told about a loan to be repaid out of the assets of 140 billion euros. Could it be, is it possible that the Europeans have already been dipping into the capital? Perhaps this is the last part of the capital left. We have all of these loans, so-called loans, which Ukraine will never repay, floating around. If the capital is gone and Ukraine goes down, who is going to be on the hook for these loans? Those who have been providing the guarantees, who are, of course, the people of Europe. Well, there's a degree of speculation here, and it may be that I'm missing something, though I can't myself see what it is. But one way or the other, this, even if this 140 billion euro loan is indeed provided to Ukraine, it can only buy a limited amount of time before, to put it simply, the checks start to bounce. So they don't actually have much fiscal space to keep this up. The United States is already worried about the size of its inventories. And the Europeans have failed to increase their production of armaments to any significant degree, as I discussed in my programme yesterday. Neither the Americans nor the Europeans, after the start of a war that has lasted for almost 4 years, have been able to get round the problem of cotton, high quality cotton fibre that is needed to make explosives for shells. So they are out of space. And I think that a lot of the morbid language, the talk about Europe and Russia being on war or in a kind of hybrid war or on the brink of war, is basically all about this. I was reading in the Financial Times today that there is some debate, very uncertain debate, in Europe apparently going on. Macron, unsurprisingly, is at the forefront of it. A couple of days ago, about 2 weeks ago, he said that it would be a mistake to simply shoot down Russian planes out of the sky without first giving warnings or doing things of that kind. Of course, now he's changed again and has once more become the arch hawk on this very question. And apparently he and some of the Baltic states and the Poles are saying, well, let us at least loosen the guidelines to make it easier for our militaries to start shooting down Russian aircraft, be they drones or other aircraft that might be a threat to our airspace. Other countries in Europe, and I'm going to make a guess that not just Hungary and Slovakia, but perhaps the Czech Republic also before long, have more doubts about this. But all of these threatening noises, all of this belligerent language, I think partly is explained by growing realization that, well, Ukraine is losing and the Europeans, there isn't anything more realistically that they can do. They can come up with this extraordinary plan to seize the Russian money, dressing it all up as a loan to Ukraine. They can come up with this plan. But that, as Fredrickson basically said, is all they have. There is no real proposal on the table to do anything else. So that's the Europeans, that's the Americans. Zelensky himself, of course, has been speaking. And he tells us more about how well Ukraine is doing on the battlefronts. He said that Ukrainian missile attacks have been incredibly successful. He appears to be implying that these are missile attacks on Donetsk, the city of Donetsk. He's threatened Belgorod and Kursk, two cities, obviously, in the western part of Russia, which have also been, at various times, have had threats or attacks from the Ukrainians. Anyway, he's threatened these two cities with energy blackouts and says that if there's an energy blackout in Ukraine, Ukraine will arrange energy blackouts for these two cities in Ukraine. He says that Ukraine has conducted and is conducting a successful counter-offensive, and that this is throwing the Russians back and has defeated their offensive in Donbass. Or at least that is, from the summaries that I have read, what Zelensky has been saying. He's saying this, of course, to the Ukrainian people. He's probably saying this to the Europeans. He's perhaps, to some extent, saying this to the Americans too. Now, what about the reality of these various claims that Zelensky is making? Well, first of all, Ukraine has made many attacks on Belgorod and Kursk. In a sense, Zelensky now talking about Belgorod and Kursk, as opposed to Moscow and St. Petersburg and other cities in Russia, shows that Zelensky no longer really believes that Ukraine has any possible chance of achieving energy blackouts in any of those great cities. What about Kursk and Belgorod? Can he do it there? Well, he has. The Ukrainians have been launching missile strikes against Belgorod, for example. And it may be that some of these missile strikes have been conducted with new missiles that the Ukrainians have been producing. Though the only missile carrier that I have seen that the Ukrainians have deployed, which has indeed launched missiles against Belgorod over the last week, has been a HIMARS missile system in Kharkiv. The Russians detected it. They found it, a drone found it, and it was destroyed by a counter-strike, a Russian counter-strike, using an Iskander missile, which is how I know about the existence of this HIMARS system that was launching these missile strikes at Belgorod. Of course, it could be that there are other missiles, as well as the HIMARS, that are also being used, but it all falls far short of the big missile offensive that Zelensky was talking about back in July. Missiles that would be launched to carry out deep strikes far inside Russia. It doesn't look to me as if that is happening, at least not for the moment. And his latest comments suggest that unless he gets his hands on real long-range missiles, the Tomahawks or the Taurus missiles or the JASSMs or something of that kind, then it doesn't look as if this is going to happen at all. I read a report somewhere that said that all attempts by Ukraine to get the Flamingo missile, this huge cruise missile, looked like a World War II era German V1 missile. All attempts by the Ukrainians to get that missile into production have been unsuccessful because the Russians have successfully destroyed all of the plants and factories which might have been involved in the destruction, in the production of this missile. So anyway, that missile offensive that Zelensky has been talking about really doesn't seem to amount to me to very much. There were indeed some missile strikes a couple of days ago by the Ukrainians on Donetsk City. The Russians said that these were conducted by HIMARS missiles. And again, I think that might have been true, but it's possible that some other missile was being used by the Ukrainians. A homegrown Ukrainian missile was used by the Ukrainians in those strikes. I mean, I don't know. But again, it doesn't seem to have made a huge amount. These strikes don't seem to have made a huge amount of difference. Just saying. So the missile offensive, the blackouts, all of that, they seem to fall well short of the boasts and claims that Zelensky is making. What about the counteroffensive that he is talking about? Well, I've discussed the fighting that's been taking place in Donbass in detail. There is only one place where the Ukrainians could be spoken about as being on the attack that I am aware of, and that is in the area northeast of Pokrovsk, where the Russians carried out their breakthrough in August, and where General Sirsky, the Ukrainian military chief, has concentrated many of Ukraine's best brigades, and according to the Russians, has been transferring the remaining, some of the remaining brigades held by Ukraine in reserve. Now, the Ukrainians have at many times, Sirsky himself has at many times made great claims about the supposed success of these counterattacks, about how supposedly the area of the Russian breakthrough has been cut off by the Ukrainians and the rest of the Russian military, how the Russians are blockaded in this area and caught in cauldrons. But like most people who follow the situation on the battlefronts closely, I have long since come to the view that none of these claims were true. Yes, the Ukrainians did conduct counterattacks. Yes, at various times they did regain some ground in this area, but overall the counterattacks were unsuccessful. They certainly fall far short of what could be described as a counter-offensive. And the Russians, over the last week or so, have regained the initiative in this very area and are instead widening the territory that they have captured, the territory of the breakthrough. They are actually increasing it. And I read an article, I read on TASS rather, a claim by Denis Pushilin, I think it was, the head of the Donetsk regional government, in which it was claimed that yes, the Ukrainians are continuing to make counterattacks in this area, but that the Russians are indeed enlarging the territory that they control. Everywhere else, On every other part of the front lines, the Russians continue to have the advantage. Again, I'm going to give a relatively brief summary, but with every day, more of Pokrovsk seems to fall under Russian control. This is according to various reports, but the reports appear to be true, and they seem to be corroborated by reliable sources. It is now, I think, largely accepted that the tipping point in the Battle of Pokrovsk has passed, and that Pokrovsk is steadily falling to the Russians. This is going to be a battle that will still take some weeks, but the Ukrainians have themselves now released pictures which show Russian soldiers on the Pokrovsk mine, west of Pokrovsk itself. This is the last remaining mine under Ukrainian control that produces coking coal, as used by Ukrainian blast furnaces to make steel, just to say. But the fighting is now underway for this mine. The Russians seem to be in the process of capturing this mine. It is widely acknowledged that if the Russians do capture this mine, the Russians will be in a strong position to cut the road, the supply road to Pokrovsk from the west, and ultimately to capture the village of Grishino that lies immediately to the north of this road. And as I've discussed in many programs, the Russians already control the entry points of the road in Pokrovsk itself, and the Ukrainian forces in southeastern and central Pokrovsk that are still holding out in apparently just one high-rise building area are essentially already cut off from supplies. So we see that claims from Russian sources like Radovka about Russian progress in Pokrovsk are true, are being proved every day to be true. And the Russians continue their offensives in all sorts of other places. They continue to break through in Zaporozhye region. It looks as if the town of Guliapolye is going to be encircled at some point within the next few weeks. They continue to advance in the area of Konstantinovka, and there is dispute about whether the Russians have broken into Konstantinovka itself and whether fighting is taking place there. But there is no dispute that the Russians are closing, are gradually tightening the ring around Konstantinovka itself. Siversk, in the battle for Siversk, further to the north, the Russians appear to be advancing on Siversk from at least four different directions. According, of course, to the Russian General Staff, the Russians are already inside northeastern Siversk, though there is no other corroboration for that claim. But there is no doubt that the Russians are advancing on Siversk from the west, the north, the east, and the south. So Siversk is being caught in a ring. There are still routes to send supplies to Siversk, but according to Gerasimov, the village of Yampol is about to fall, and nobody believes that supplies can reach Siversk if the Russians, or rather when the Russians, capture Yampol. With every day that passes, the battle for Siversk reminds me more and more of the battle for Ugledar last year. Like Ugledar, Siversk was this fortified, heavily fortified town which dominates the surrounding landscape. It's apparently surrounded by a cluster of villages, a dense network of railways, and some small water bodies, all of which create natural defences. very much like Ugladá, because of the high-rise buildings that made it up, dominated its surrounding landscape. And I believe that Siversk also is on high ground, though one should be careful about this because it's not exactly a hill or anything like that. The point is that the Russians are now surrounding Siversk from many sides. The supply routes to the town are going to be cut off. The Ukrainian defenders there, like the ones in Ugladá, appear to be picked, chosen from some of the best brigades that Ukraine has. But as happened in Ugladá, there will probably be a simultaneous attack from multiple directions once the supply roads are cut, and then it will all be over probably within 2 or 3 days. We will see a collapse, and in contrast to Ugladá, where there were at least theoretical escape routes over the fields to Ukrainian villages that were still held by the Ukrainians to the north, I don't see any places close to Siversk where the Ukrainian soldiers who try to flee Siversk can realistically escape to. With the town of Liman, the next place west of Siversk, also itself now under siege. And, well, the Ukrainians have themselves provided maps now and videos of the situation of the Ukrainian defenders in Kupiansk. And, well, it does seem to me that the claims that the Ukrainians are trapped in Kupiansk are probably true. They seem to be in a small cluster of buildings on the west bank of the Oskol River. I think it would be extremely difficult and very dangerous to try to escape over a river like that in autumn. I can't see that this battle can end well for the Ukrainian soldiers in Kupiansk. And, well, probably the reason this battle is taking so long is precisely because the Ukrainian defenders have nowhere to escape to, which means that the Russians have to flush them out one building at a time. So Zelensky is once again giving a completely false impression of the state of the battlefields. Some of his words have been reproduced in the British media as if they were true. I don't believe that they reflect in any way the actual reality. The only question for me is whether Zelensky is being told some of these things by Sirsky about successes in the counterattacks northeast of Pokrovsk and believes them. In other words, whether Sirsky is deceiving Zelensky, or whether Zelensky himself is party to this deception that Sirsky himself is involved in. Now, what about the Russians? Well, Peskov has been talking on Putin's behalf, and he has said this, and I take this from TASS: there's been a significant pause in dialogue between Russia and the United States. The dialogue as a follow-up of the Istanbul talks is stalled. Ukraine has not provided any feedback on the documents. Our process is at a standstill. So Russian proposals to set up 3 working parties, to look for ways forward, all of that has gone completely unanswered. Peskov has also said that discussions between the Americans and the Russians are indeed at a standstill about improving relations between the United States and Russia, exactly as Ryabkov himself has said. Now, I have been, I've had more opportunity to now familiarize myself with what Sergei Ryabkov, the Russian deputy foreign minister, said in his report to the Duma. And if possible, it goes even further beyond what I said in my program yesterday. He says that there's been no agreement on restoring air links between Russia and the United States. He said that there's been no agreement on sorting out the problems in terms of the diplomats, the embassies, the functioning of the embassies. The Russians have received no coherent response from the United States about their proposal for a one-year extension of the START Treaty, which is due to expire in February next year. In every respect, the discussions between the United States and Russia are at a complete impasse. A mountain has moved in terms of diplomacy between the United States and Russia since Trump's inauguration, and it has resulted substantively in absolutely nothing at all. There's been no progress on settling the conflict in Ukraine. There's been no progress in improving relations between Russia and the United States. Ryabkov, in fact, went further. He said that the House of Russia-US relations is filled with cracks, and the cracks now reach down to the very foundations. Now, a lot of people say, one gets this all the time, that all of this proves that Putin was wasting his time in his discussions with Trump, and that Putin having these discussions with Trump somehow resulted in a weakening of the Russian position on the battlefronts, though it has never been explained to me in what way. To repeat again a point I have made many, many times, in all of Putin's interactions with Trump, in all of the discussions that the Russians and the Americans have engaged in since Trump's inauguration, the Russians have never budged an inch, not a millimeter, from the positions that they set out in Putin's speech to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024. In other words, in terms of the conditions for which they intend to end the war. There has never been a retreat by the Russians from any one of these points. Trump proposed the ceasefire. They rejected the ceasefire. Trump and Kellogg have floated the idea of a freeze. The Russians have said they're not interested in a freeze. The Russians have always said that NATO remains a red line. NATO membership for Ukraine remains a red line. Any peace agreement must confirm that Ukraine will never join NATO, not in any circumstances, and must be legally foolproof, something which, by the way, I've never seen myself how that could ever be achieved. And the Russians have never shown any public sign that they are prepared to waver over the control of the four regions, Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson, that they consider to be part of Russia. In Putin's meeting with the generals, the one that took place 2 days ago, and which I discussed in my program yesterday, Putin also discussed the status of the four regions. He spoke about the referendums that took place in the four regions in September 2022. He spoke of the four regions as part of Russia. And I've never seen any sign myself that the Russians have wavered or retreated on any of this. There's been all kinds of reports, claims, speculations that Putin at one point said to Witkoff that if the Ukrainians pulled out of Donbass, pulled out of Donetsk, the Russians might agree to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions on the existing front lines. But all of those reports, every one of them, without exception, has come from Western sources. Not one has been confirmed by any Russian source. None at all. So, firstly, I don't see that there's any evidence that the Russians have given any ground to the Americans, or Putin specifically, has given any ground to the Americans on the basis upon which the Ukrainian conflict can be settled. What a breakthrough, a diplomatic breakthrough to settle the conflict would have required is some American willingness to address the conditions, the terms that Putin set out in his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June, 2024. And that has never happened. It may be that if the Americans had been willing to talk to the Russians about these terms, the individual aspects of these terms, it might be that if the Ukrainians had done so, if they accepted the Russian suggestion to set up three working parties, that the Russians might at that point have shown flexibility on at least some of these issues. But that negotiation has never taken place, and that is the point the Russians are now making. Moreover, what we get instead is this idiotic idea, and I do think it is idiotic and unbelievably reckless, to send Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine in order to try to get leverage from the Russians so that the Russians come round and accept the American proposals, Kellogg's proposals, for a freeze. Now, I've also now had a better opportunity to get a better handle of what Putin said over the course of his conversation, his recent conversation with Zarubin. Now, contrary to what I believed, what I initially assumed, that conversation, the conversation between Putin and Zarubin, took place before the Valdai conference in Sochi. So when Putin said to Zarubin that if the Americans supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, that will be the end of discussions about improving relations between Russia and the United States. He said that before he said the same thing during the conference in Sochi. I'd misunderstood this point before. I want to make that fact clear, to clarify that fact, though I don't think it makes any substantive difference, actually, in terms of understanding the current Russian position. But Putin went beyond discussing what the effect of Tomahawk missile deliveries on US-Russian relations would be. Because I agree here again with Larry Johnson on Sonar 21 that Putin essentially said that the very fact that the Tomahawk missile deliveries are being discussed, the dynamics of the conflict make it inevitable that the Russian army is going to push beyond the four regions. And he seemed to be giving the military the light, the green light to advance beyond the four regions. Now, if you go back to Putin's meeting with the generals, with Gerasimov and the other generals in St. Petersburg, essentially it was the same thing. As I've discussed previously, he said nothing about diplomacy, nothing about negotiations with the United States, nothing about negotiations with Ukraine. It was all about achieving military victory. But it's absolutely clear to me that it is the military who are deciding things on the battlefields, not Putin. And the military's objective, to reiterate this again, is control, eventual control of Ukraine's entire Black Sea coast, including Nikolaev and Odessa, and by the way, probably Nikopol and Kryvyi Rog as well. Just to say. So, this, it seems to me, is what we are facing now. Now, on the military strategies and on the way in which the war has been conducted, again, to repeat once more, it's a point I've made now endlessly, but I will repeat again. I believe that Putin micromanaged the military campaign in the early months when he was trying to negotiate with the Ukrainians a settlement of the conflict. I think that at some point in 2022, he stopped doing so and handed over complete control of the military side of the war to Gerasimov and the general staff. We saw from the discussion with the generals that the general staff are conducting the war in accordance with their own plan. If you think that there is something wrong with Russian military tactics, as many people seem to, if you believe that the Russians should move faster and absorb more casualties and attempt big arrow offensives and those sort of things, it seems to me that you ought to be addressing your complaints to the Russian military, not to Putin. I, not being a military man, don't feel that I have any competence to do that. I myself find it a little strange that people want to do that, given that the Russians are visibly winning the war. But anyway, it seems to me that the complaints need to be addressed to the right place, not against Putin himself. Anyway, Putin himself has been busy. He is now in Dushanbe, in Tajikistan, one of the Central Asian republics of the former Soviet Union. This trip had been organized some time ago, but there has been an interesting development and an interesting twist in it, because over the course of this trip, he's had what appears to be a very friendly meeting with the president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev. And apparently, just prior to Putin's trip to Tajikistan, there was a telephone call, a very friendly and constructive telephone call between Aliyev and Putin. This call apparently took place on the 7th of October, and the two leaders agreed to meet. Now, there's never been a readout for that call, and I don't know who initiated the call, but I am going to guess that it was Aliyev, that it was Aliyev who suggested the call, and that it was he who said to Putin, look, I know you're going to Dushanbe, why don't we meet there? Relations between our countries have not been good over the last couple of months. Now's the time for us to have a meeting and to sort it out. And it's been disclosed that Aliyev and Putin also had a conversation whilst they were both in China to in connection with the celebrations of China's victory over Japan in the Second World War. Now, the Russian transcript of at least part of the meeting between Aliyev and Putin relates to the shooting down, the loss of an Azerbaijanian aircraft that was passenger jet that was leaving the town of Grozny in Chechnya, in northern Caucasus, within Russia. This was an unpleasant incident, upsetting incident, and of course people died over the course of it. There's been an investigation. Putin took personal charge of the investigation. It is confirmed that the aircraft was indeed brought down as a result of mistakes by the Russian air defences. It seems that there were Russian, Ukrainian drones in the sky. The Russian air defences were firing at those drones. Unfortunately, the aircraft was brought down as a result. Putin has apologised. Aliyev seems minded to accept this apology. There is talk of the Russians paying compensation. This is only one of the many incidents between Azerbaijan and Russia which have taken place. We've had arrests of people in Azerbaijanian citizens in Yekaterinburg. We've had pressure by the Russian authorities on members of the Azerbaijanian diaspora. The Azerbaijanian authorities in return have retaliated by arresting Russian citizens in Azerbaijan itself. The Russians, for their part, have been conducting air and missile strikes against Azerbaijanian-owned and controlled refineries and energy installations on Ukrainian territory. I always thought, knowing the history of the relations between these two leaders, Aliyev and Putin, that this whole quarrel would eventually be patched up, and it looks as if it has. My guess is that what triggered this whole series of events was those arrests in Yekaterinburg, with suggestions that some people in Yekaterinburg connected to Azerbaijan were passing on classified information about Russian defense enterprises and their work in Yekaterinburg. And Aliyev, as he had to, responded strongly to this, but then the Russians retaliated by attacking parts of Azerbaijan's energy system. Azerbaijan is dependent economically on the export of energy. The Azerbaijanians ultimately realized that they had no choice but to make up with the Russians. And that, it seems to me, is what has happened. The Russians have great skill and experience handling relations with individual Caucasian states. With Azerbaijan, as I said, they've succeeded in sorting out the problems. They are making progress in doing the same with Georgia, which is resisting counter-revolution, or rather, shall I say, color revolutions, and those sort of things. I am confident that before long, in due course, the Russians will get a handle on the situation in Armenia too. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish the program today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, let me remind you again to tick the like button and also to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.